So I'd like to continue on with the teachings about faith. And this has been one continuous Dharma talk in a way. Each of us are here already because we have some faith. We have some heart-based understanding that these teachings are not just a religion. They're a way of dealing with life so that we can understand for ourselves what leads to goodwill in ourselves and in others, and finding ways to nurture that. How can we recognize in our thoughts, in our speech, in our behavior, what leads to happiness and peace, goodwill, loving kindness, compassion towards one another, wisdom. And bringing our attention to those places in our speech, our behavior, even in our thoughts, where we can go in that direction. And then we also begin to recognize what causes harm in us, what causes ill will, harm towards others. Can we relinquish that before we act it out in our speech, in our behavior, even in our thoughts? So we learn to pay attention, not just to what leads to goodwill, but what leads to ill will also within us. And it's said in the Dharma that these two things, understanding what leads to peace, harmony, goodwill, understanding what leads to the opposite of that, that forms the basis, that forms the platform upon which deep understanding, deep wisdom can come. Liberation can come from that. So we do our practice with great sincerity, and we make mistakes all the time. It's just human. When we're not perfect, of course we're not. We learn to forgive ourselves. We learn to forgive others, because that is the way towards leading a life where we feel that our heart can be freer and freer. So we have some heart-based intelligence. It's not just because somebody tells us this is the right way to do it. It's because we see for ourselves that this is the way to do it that leads to freedom. We see the results from when other people are doing it. We see the results both ways, when people are doing it in a way that we see leads to more suffering, and we see the way we or other people are doing it that leads to more liberation. And it can get really shaky sometimes, and we may feel we're on tender hooks and we're not... We can't go through it during that time. But when we can stay with it, when we can bring our attention to those places inside of us, see, oftentimes, as I've seen in the groups and in my own experience, oftentimes, you know, we talk about the practice really being, the real practice being out there in the world. And we're doing what we can in the world in relationship with one another to do the best we can. Of course we do that. And the Dharma helps us find those ways too. But a lot of the times we forget that in those very situations, one of the basic things we can do is tune into ourselves and find out what's going on here in relationship to out there. In that very moment we can do that. And oftentimes it brings all the back and forth that we're talking about with somebody. It just, we don't need to do that anymore. We can, or at least for that moment, we can drop down into the heart and say with humility, I'm feeling confused. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling sad about this. And we're saying the truth, not because we're trying to shame somebody else or trying to be right, or trying to make somebody feel we were wronged, but just because we want to tell the truth of how it is. And oftentimes that just brings about the clarity right there in that moment. So a lot of the work we do here in the quietness really helps us to be out there, and out there helps us to be back here, so we can be with ourselves really and know the truth for ourselves. So this is faith, the ability to have some heart-based intelligence. The faith comes from really coming from being in our hearts and not just trying to figure it out intellectually or psychologically. It really helps. I mean, I'm a patient of psychology. I have my own therapist that I can go to and talk things out on a therapeutic level, and it's really helpful. But it also helps to team with that, the ability to really look at myself in a soberingly honest way. So the characteristic of faith I talked about is trusting. And it's about trusting what we understand ourselves from experience, not because it's from here, but experientially from the heart. The word in Pali is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. That means faith in Pali, that ancient language. And it means placing your heart upon, placing your heart upon, placing your heart upon what you trust to be true out of your own experience. And sometimes, of course, the experience of others helps us, and we might feel that we can, that harmonizes with us very deeply. And so we can borrow that and see, does this really work for us too? It doesn't mean that we don't pay attention to others. We can do that, of course. And that trusting, that characteristic of trusting, brings about what is called the function of faith. This is all from the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology. Trusting what we know to be true by experience brings about the function of faith, which is to clarify what's going on in our hearts, in our minds, and therefore, and in relationship to others. Clarifying, like that clear gem, there's a water purifying gem that you put in water that's kind of all muddied and stirred up, and when you put that gem into water, it makes everything settle down, and then you see what's going on from that settling down. The water becomes clear. It's not foggy anymore. You are able to see what's going on in that moment. And you have clarity, at least more clarity. You have trust in seeing what's true. And when that happens, it said the function is also to be able to enter into crossing a great flood. Its ability to cross something that's really different, that's really difficult, that we've never done before. When things are clarified, when the function appears, the function of sadha or faith appears, we're able to cross the troubled waters of our hearts, of our life. So another function of faith is to be able to cross the flood, the troubled waters of our hearts, of our minds. To overcome the opposition, that's the third function of faith, to overcome the opposition. So what is the opposition? It's not something out there, it's fear. It's fear of facing what we need to face. It's doubt, the opposite of faith. It's doubt that we can't do it. And that stops us from going forth into the flood of the waters. So tomorrow I'm going to talk about the manifestation of faith. I won't go into that now, which is resolution and that decisiveness inside you that really supports you, that determination that really supports you to go forth. So some years ago, I decided to realize one of my long-held aspirations, and that was, I became a mother very young in life. That's why I have a 46-year-old daughter. It's like unbelievable that, you know, I went through that much of life already. And one of my long-held aspirations was to become a nun. When I was younger, I thought I wanted to become a Catholic nun, you know, because I was raised in that tradition. But I realized that I really wanted to take some time of that kind of renunciation to really find a place where inside of me, can I renounce even further? So at the age of 54, the children, now grown up, had left the home, and I was able, with a lot of support around me, to take some time in Burma to ordain as a Buddhist nun. And that was really my calling, as I came to find out. So I took a very short time to ordain as a nun in Burma under my preceptor, Sayadaw Upandita. And that was a very special time for me. As I look back, I think it was one of the most important times of my life to do that. To be able to feel held in the whole lineage. This may not vibe with a lot of you, but it was very special to me that I was able to really be part of the line of the whole lineage and feel the protection and support of the Sangha and of the whole sasana, of the teachings and the teachers from here up to the time of the Buddha. And to feel that strength that I could feel so that I could renounce greed, hatred, and delusion even more deeply than I had ever renounced before. And I didn't know whether that would be possible at all, but at least my intention was there to go for it, to try it. So I took that short time, and somehow I could intuitively trust that faith was pointing me in a new direction, in a new aspiration, that I wanted to be able to embark upon a path of greater purification. And it wasn't about not eating chocolates, or which would still be good for me, but or things like that, or renouncing my life as a householder. But it really meant being able to see when things came up in my own heart and mind, like holding on to an idea or having angry thoughts that, you know, I just couldn't let go of. And just being able to see through them somehow in a way I'd never seen through them before. So that was my faith, and it brought about new aspiration for me, aspirations that I didn't have before. Can I let go of deeper roots of suffering? So I spoke this afternoon about the different kinds of faith, the blind faith, where it's really misplaced, where we believe in something outside has to be kind of put on us. And that's not what a lot of us have, really, because we see that sometimes, of course, but most of us really see either the bright faith or the more developed faith, the verified faith that we know for ourselves. Maybe we're inspired by those people outside of us, but we know for ourselves to some degree what leads to peace and what leads to suffering. We know what path to take and what path to renounce. So I was born into the Catholic faith, and I just want to say about the bright faith that I had and where it pointed me to. So when I was living in the Philippines, you know, I was born in the Philippines and I came to America very young. I was raised here. We immigrated here and to America. And then I went back to the Philippines. And at the age of 17, I was betrothed a marriage that my mother made and my future husband's parents made. I didn't make that. So I went back to the Philippines and I lived there. And I realized that this was not really the life that I wanted. You know, came from very poor family, and all of a sudden I was in a very wealthy, politically highly ranked family. And it came time when, I'm trying to make this story short, it came time when I knew I had to leave the Philippines and I had to protect my children. And it took a long time to leave. I was, I had one child that was born in America just before I went there. And I could bring her back to America, but I had two children born in the Philippines, and I couldn't leave with those children because they were Philippine citizens, and it was martial law, and I was in a family that was in the opposition. So I had to get the American government to get me and my children out of the Philippines without my husband's family knowing about it. I mean, it was really huge. And I got out of the country, and with the help of the embassy, I got out of the country, and we came back here. One of the things that got me out of the country was a very interesting experience. In the morning, the cook of our household said that in the next village, there's an apparition. Can we go? I just came from the market. She said, we should go there. And so everybody was so interested in this. Now, some of you may think this is woo-woo, but this is what happens in countries like the Philippines and in Brazil and in Spain. And, you know, there's a lot of a kind of faith that believes in things that are mysterious in a way. So we went, you know, the household, and we went. And so, and the children, and followed this little road around in back of the market. And lo and behold, at the top of these palm trees, there was an apparition of the Blessed Mother. Okay, so whatever you believe is what you believe, but I saw it. And so there were a lot of us that, you know, I can understand why people fall to their knees, because it's so astounding. You know, there's no screen up there. There's nobody. It's just this whatever woman standing there. And so there was a question asked of me. And the question, the woman was looking around with her hands. I saw her hands, and her feet were bare, and her face was bare, and she was wearing robes. And the question to me was, what are you doing here? So it was a question for me to investigate. She wasn't telling me what to do. She was saying, what are you doing here? And I really thought about that, like, what am I doing here? That's true. What am I doing here in this family, in this layer of society? This is not my world, you know. And so that question made me investigate what's happening with my life. What is the purpose of my life, really? Is it to just have this endless bank account and to be in this level of society and to, you know, I had six maids and a driver. That wasn't me, you know. I would always want to go wash the dishes, and they'd want to shoo me out of the kitchen. So it was kind of put back to me. What am I doing here? So this is what, when we're in practice, we're asking ourselves, and we're trying to see inside, what are we here for? What is our life really all about? I remember asking Manindra that question shortly after I came back to America with my three children. I met Manindraji in a retreat, and when I asked Manindra, what is the purpose of my life? This is what I'm trying to find out. I was young, in my 20s. And he said, the purpose of one's life as a human being is to develop wisdom and compassion. And so I got some kind of a clue, you know, that's the direction I'm headed in. It's not about getting all these things and being having a certain role in society or whatever it is, but it's really to develop those qualities. And how could I do that? So actually, this apparition was that bright faith for me in that Catholic religion, you know. So I appreciate, and I still very much appreciate that place that I came from. So that aspiration became more clear to me, to develop wisdom, to develop compassion. And it came out of that question, and it set a new direction in my life. And that's how I ended up at a retreat during that time. What happened, came to America, mother of three small children. I had not ever taken care of them, you know, when they were born. And so it was like, wow, what am I doing? But, you know, just by the seat of my pants, I did pretty good. They're all pretty good people. So how I got to this path was, I was on my way home from someplace, and I was living in California. And on the way back home, I passed by the University of California in Santa Cruz. And there was a big sign outside on the highway that said, there is this gathering. There's some kind of thing happening there. So turned in and wanted to see what was going on. And those were like, that was in the 70s and kind of the still hippie days, you know. So I went in with the children, and I went into this big cavernous gymnasium. And they were pulling at me, and they didn't want to be there, you know, and there was drumming, and there was incense, and there were all these booths around of what they were kind of wanting you to come to, their whatever it was that they were drawing you towards. And way in the corner, like in the back corner on the right-hand side, was a sign. There were all kinds of wonderful things, but there was a sign that said, silent retreat. And here all these kids are pulling on me, and I said, that's where I'm going. And I made a beeline for that place, you know. And then I asked, well, what is this? And they told me about it. And so I went to that a weekend retreat. And from that weekend retreat, I signed up for a month-long retreat with Manindraji. And I didn't stay there the whole month, but I had to go home once in a while. I had people taking care of the children, relatives and friends. But I came to understand from that place of silent retreat, you know, all the things, all the turmoil, all the stuff that was going on in my heart and my mind that I really needed for it to come up and to see. So faith was like a spiritual compass to me. It kind of led me in a direction, and it's why I'm here today and why I still go through the dukkha that I go through to understand more deeply. So here I ordained as a Buddhist nun at the age of 54 after raising the children. And I arrived at the forest center in Burma and went to pay my respects to the teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, highly regarded Buddhist monk, bhikkhu, who also is the teacher of Aung San Suu Kyi. So I feel like he is really strong. I mean, he is such a protector of freedom in Burma. So I went to pay respects to him. And when I entered the room and did my bows, he said very forthrightly to me, why are you here? You know, he's very, I feel his loving kindness so thoroughly. But when he talks, you don't waste any time. You know, he says, why are you here? You've come from the comfort of home, and you're going to be here in this with these robes. And I mean, I couldn't even wear them straight. I was always getting reprimanded for wearing them the wrong way. And he said, why are you here? And I just didn't take me long to say, I've come to purify my heart more. He just said, okay. And then he said, in order to do that, you must invest everything you have in the Dharma. You must invest everything you have in the Dharma, in your practice. And I thought, what does he mean? Surely he didn't mean financial stuff or material stuff. But what he meant to say, and I knew it very clearly, is look inside of yourself and see what you have, the qualities that you have, to be able to do this kind of renunciation, to be able to do this kind of practice. Do you have all the qualities of faith? You know, the balance of faith and a certain kind of wisdom. That's the balance of faith. Do you have enough concentration and energy balancing each other out? Do you have enough of an ability to be with your mindful attention in a momentum that kind of leads you to deeper and deeper and more understanding? And so other qualities like compassion, like loving kindness, like equanimity, many qualities, that's what we're investing when we do our practice here on the cushion or out in the world. That's what we're investing. You must be able to invest everything you have in the practice. So we need so much faith to be able to look at ourselves and see what is there. Do we have the faith in ourselves to actually acknowledge what we have in ourselves to give to our practice and to give to others along the way? Because it's not just for ourselves, as we know. It's to be able to use that in the world. And so I know that it must be true what he was saying, that I really had to recognize the strengths of my heart and have faith in them and bring them forth in my practice. So even though I was also, you know, painfully aware of my limitations, of the places where I couldn't do my best, I was also aware of those places that were strong in me. And so sometimes in the West, you know, we're not so practiced at saying, yeah, because we feel like maybe we're bragging about ourselves to say, yeah, I have strength, or I have a lot of faith in myself, or I have a good amount of equanimity, or I feel that I do have loving kindness. It does manifest in myself and in the world. It's so important to be able to acknowledge that about ourselves and then to give each other that acknowledgement. I mean, half of the my side of the holy life when I'm a spiritual friend is actually mirroring that to people, you know, to saying, oh, I see that this is what's happening. So how we can be a spiritual friend to others is to recognize that in others. So trusting that in ourselves too. It's said that in our practice we learn to establish faith in three ways. And I've talked a lot about the last way that's noted, having faith in ourselves. Talked a lot about that, and I'll still talk more about that tomorrow. To have that faith in ourselves, experientially understanding how to navigate this path for ourselves. But there's also faith in the teachings and faith in the teachers. And I want to talk a little bit about that now. So the three ways we learn to establish faith is faith in the teachers, faith in the teachings, and faith in oneself. So faith in the teachers. I want to tell you another story about Munindraji. When I went to that 1 month retreat and I had never met him, I came late. There was not a place to sleep anymore at the retreat. All the beds were taken, all the rooms were taken. But there was, some of us were being placed like in hallways and things like that. So I was given this small futon, like a camping thing that you blow up. And I was told that this is where I could sleep. And it was outside in a hallway, just outside of Munindraji's bathroom. So Munindraji, I recognized him because he's this beautiful, shiny, bald-headed, brown man and with white robes. And he looks like an ice cream man, you know, with chocolate. Anyway, I think about chocolate a lot, I guess. So, and he was coming towards me, and I knew, oh, that must be Munindraji. So I was putting my bed down and laying things down, and he approached me, and he said, "Is this where you will sleep?" in his beautiful accent. And I said, "Yes, there's no more place, but this is fine. I have a place to sleep." And he said, "You look tired." And I said, "Yeah, I'm tired. I mean, three kids, getting them all set up." I said, "Yes, I'm very tired, but I'll be fine here." And he said, "You must get good rest when you're practicing. You must get good rest. And it's better that you have your place to rest." So he said, "I can sleep on your mat, and you can take my room." And I thought, right away I thought, this is a good teacher. You know, just so humble, so down to earth, not prideful that he's done all this practice or anything, but just compassionate, ready to give something of himself. And he said, "Look, I have this place, I can put the mat down." He opened the door and I saw the bathroom was really big. You know, it even had a rug in it. So he said, "I will sleep here and you can take my room." And the room was, you know, down the hall a little bit. So that's where I stayed during that retreat. And I realized that this is a sign of a good teacher. So I right away, I had faith in him. He didn't always exhibit, you know, those wonderful qualities. But I could just see deep down what a wonderful person he was. And then when I heard the Dharma from him, it was like, wow, he could say things that were in the, you know, ancient words of the Buddha in Pali and then say them in English. And then he was a person that if you asked him a question, he would not stop answering that question until the last person in the room got up and left. You know, he would just keep going on and on and on. So a teacher, you know, choosing a teacher that you can have faith in, or many of them. In the West, there are many teachers. And some we take a little from one and a little from other, and it kind of, we find our way through the goodness of the many teachers and our spiritual friends. But one time, I was not, it was during a time when there were a lot of teachers coming over from India. And there was this one teacher that, I had many friends going to see this teacher, and I heard many wonderful things from my friends and saw a lot of transformation in my friends practicing with this teacher. And the teacher wrote many beautiful books. But there were some things that the teacher was doing that wasn't really holding the totality and the integrity of being a teacher. And I went to Manindraji and I said, how do I hold this? I really don't know how to hold this. And I mean, it really wasn't that bad, but it was still like I expected some kind of perfection from the teacher. And Manindraji said to me, he said, look, even for myself, my path is not yet finished. You will see that there are things that I will exhibit that you'll be confused about. So even for myself, he would always say, my path is not yet finished. And then when I asked him about the teacher, he said, a perfect rose can come from an imperfect giver. And I always remembered that we can, sometimes we can take the teachings, they can be so beautiful and brilliant. We can take the teachings in and know what they mean for us. And we can put aside, you know, our judgments or opinions about someone. We can just put that aside and look to the beauty of what they're offering, because oftentimes they're really coming from the purity of their hearts. And so it's so important to do that with the teachings, you know, to see that the teachings sometimes, there are so many of us that our path is not yet finished. And to expect perfection from a teacher is not realistic. It's just not realistic. So to be able to know what you can take into your heart from the teachings, see the goodness of whatever is being given to you and from where it's being given, and separate the rest. And just, you know, everybody's trying to find their own way. So having faith in the teachers requires a lot of discrimination, of discernment. Can you take what's being given? Having faith in the teachings, I mean, that's the teachings from the Buddha and from any of the great masters are so pure. So when it says having faith in the teachings, traditionally it means having faith in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. So what does that mean in terms of where we are in the West? We weren't all raised with like Deepama and Manindraji from the Barua family, you know, that align straight up to the Buddha. What does that mean for us? So having faith in the Buddha, what it means for us could be having faith in our own potential to awaken. The Buddha was a human being. When the Buddha was asked, are you a god? Are you an angel or a celestial being? And the Buddha would say, no, I'm not. And, well, what are you? The Buddha answered, I am awake, awakened to the truth of life. So that is our potential. Maybe not to be of that level of knowing all that there is to know of what you could put your mind to, like a Buddha, it is said, could do. But we can be awake to life. And if we can believe in that potential for ourselves, then we're really believing in Buddhahood in a way. The Buddha was a human being just like all of us are. So having faith in the Buddha, having faith in the Dharma, this is one of the traditional meanings of faith in the teachings. Having faith in the Dharma is having faith in the Four Noble Truths. So, you know, the Four Noble Truths are, the first one is, there is suffering, there is the truth of suffering. It is not as erroneously described as life is suffering. That's true, but it isn't totally all that. There is the truth of suffering. So what the Buddha started with is being able to face that, to start from that place, not to say, I just want all the bliss, but to open to everything there is in life. There is a truth of suffering. There is a cause of suffering, the second noble truth. The third noble truth, there is an end to suffering. There can be an end to suffering. And the fourth noble truth is there is a path to the end of suffering. And so that path is the Eightfold Noble Path. So in brief, the having faith in the teachings is having faith in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path. There's a little more to that, but in a nutshell. And it doesn't have to be a Buddha's teaching. It's kind of a universal understanding. We can, those things can be said in a very universal way. Like someone said to me a long time ago, it's not, you know, it's very practical, but this whole understanding of the Dharma is very practical. It's just, it's not just common sense, but it's advanced common sense. You know, the Dharma's understanding it more deeply. So by having trust in ourselves, and that's really where we need to start, we can begin to venture into having trust in the teachings, really trying them on and saying, is this really true? And having trust in teachers that we choose that will offer the teachings in a way that can be taken in and that we can try out for ourselves. So when we can have faith in that, in ourselves, in the teachings, and in the teachers, maybe we'll be able to go further in our path where we can take on, we can navigate places in ourselves and in our lives that are right now more difficult to navigate, where we can have a relationship with what's happening inside of us and outside of us that can bring more peace to ourselves and more peace to others. So these are just part of the understandings about faith. And you're going to take all of these strands of understanding faith and kind of weave them into your own life and your own heart and see what works for you. Where do you need to be in the understanding of faith right now? In all that was presented today by myself, by the others you've heard around you. And see where it is that you need to maybe put more energy, more understanding for yourself. So tomorrow I'd like to talk more about resolve, resolution, determination to stay on your path, patience to be able to do that, maybe compassion for yourself, for others, as you see the places where we falter in our faith. So for now, let's let all the words pass away, dissolve, and just come back to being with the simple things of our bodies and our minds, just being here, sitting here. And sometimes faith is about just being willing to welcome whatever comes, as we train to do in our Vipassana practice over and over again. Take the seat in the middle of the room. Open the doors and windows, as Ajahn Chah says, and welcome whatever comes in without expectation, without needing to change anything. or fix anything or get rid of anything. Just staying open to what comes and goes in the body, in the mind, in the heart. I'd like to end again with David White. In this high place, it is as simple as this. Leave everything you know behind. Step towards the cold surface. Say the old prayer of rough love and open both arms. Those who come with empty hands will stare into the lake astonished. There in the cold light, reflecting pure snow, the true shape of your own face. Thank you for your practice today. Mm-hmm.